Welcome to Marketing FYI, a periodic podcast featuring yours truly, David E. Bowman, and the one-man marketing juggernaut known as Mr. Kevin Dugan. How are you, Kevin?
Juggernautish.
Very good. Today's edition is the 2010 Year in Review edition. It's going to be a fabulous podcast, and for this very special edition, we are joined by a very special guest, the man, the myth, the legend, the CMO of NM Insight, Mr. Pete Blackshaw. Pete, how are you today?
Great. Thanks for inviting me. Excited to be here.
Hey, thank you so much for joining us on this edition of Marketing FYI. When Kevin and I were pondering...
We're held up in Dayton.
Dayton is lovely as always. We're 85 and sunny up here today. How's Cincy?
It's pretty miserable, but I guess I'll get through it.
Oh, yeah, that'll be all right. Kevin and I, when we were kind of pondering, all right, what are we going to do for episode 2 of Marketing FYI, we came up with the very original idea of, well, what if we look back at 2010 and look forward at 2011, because it is December and that's what you do. So then we asked ourselves, well, who could speak to past, present, and future with authority, insight, and, of course, charisma? And at the top of our list was Mr. P. Blackshaw, who then was very kind and said yes after repeated begging and pleading from us. So without further ado, as we like to say, let's do this thing. Pete, as 2010 ends, in general, what would you say is sort of the state of marketing and media? What's 2010 kind of been all about? Where have we come from? What have we learned?
Well, I think it was both kind of evolutionary and revolutionary. I think we saw, you know, continued migration of consumers to all things online. But the nature of the online behavior pivoted significantly. We started to interact less with websites, more through apps. We clearly consumed a lot of online activity vis-a-vis mobile devices. And it's not that that wasn't around before 2010, but I think a lot of us really found an important tipping point in terms of the way we used, you know, mobile devices and apps and, you know, even some of the habits at home that have kind of transformed, you know, not only by the iPhone, but also by the iPad. So it was a tumultuous year, and I think it's one that begs a lot of interesting questions for marketers. You know, how do we, you know, a lot of them are kind of continuing themes that we've talked about before, but if anything, they're more urgent than ever before. Things like, you know, how do we transform service into the new marketing at a time when it's still really hard to advertise the traditional way that consumers, a lot of the way we demonstrate our brand proposition is by solving problems and being a solution for, you know, for consumers. You know, how do we deal with smaller interfaces? I mean, we've barely begun to tackle that one, but we're going to have to move to a whole new era of kind of flashcard marketing where we're not going to have the luxury of too many, you know, too much extraneous information or distraction. And then we're going to have to make things much simpler. And again, we tend to make things really complex as marketers, so we're going to have to really, you know, wear our consumer hats and really think about, okay, what would make for a meaningful experience for us as consumers, not just, you know, how do we do things the way we typically do as marketers.
I like to think, too, maybe as 2010 of the year that the ideas of a lot of these things have been around for a long time, and finally the technology caught up. So a lot of what we're seeing was on the Jetsons 50 years ago.
A lot of, you know, like your QR codes have really found a tipping point, and I'm sure they'll find an even bigger tipping point in 2011. But I think about my experience co-leading digital marketing at P&G in the late 90s. A lot of the things that are now happening today, this ability to scan a product and then look at pricing information or even consumer reviews or any type of content that might impact the purchase decision, those are things that we kind of anticipated way back when, but we were just too ahead of its time. Now the devices are really in the hands of consumers, and the apps are pretty good. And you know, so the theory that we kind of laid out many years ago is really for the first time being realized.
I think that's a good point. I think, you know, with mobile this year, I mean, how do you not focus on the iPad as part of that discussion? You know, April 3rd, 2010, the apps have driven it, but I really feel, too, that things like QR codes have helped in that regard, and mobile's, you know, really become a glue of sorts between the online experience and the in-store experience, you know, and I think apps have helped with that, QR codes have helped with that sense of discovery, And I think we're going to see a lot more of it in 2011. But, you know, iPad was heralded as what single-handedly saving the publishing industry. And while I think that's a stretch, I do feel like it gave the publishing industry a second wind, and I've been impressed at some of the things that they've been doing as it relates to print now merging into the iPad universe.
And I think the iPad really was, I think, kind of both disruptive and revolutionary on a number of fronts. Number one, it wasn't anything what we expected. I mean, I think a lot of us initially poo-pooed it, thinking, boy, we don't need a dumbed-down version of a netbook. But, in fact, that's really wasn't what it was all about. It was for a while, I was calling it portable TV. I found myself finding it incredibly easy to watch TV. In fact, if anything, it totally spoiled me because I actually started doing less video consumption on my iPhone because I just found that interface too small. And then there are certain sensory things that I think we underestimated. Just this whole notion of touch, it's a different experience on the iPad than the iPhone and some of the apps. I mean, being a father of three, I'd say a significant percentage of the time I spend is with my kids drawing, you know, using the pottery tool or the drawing tool. And it's really amazing what you can create. And that's just a completely different model. It's not that you can't do things like that on your PC, but there's something about putting your finger on the screen and kind of creating, and I think we're just in the first innings of where that is going to take us. If anything, I think it's going to force marketers to think about, you know, what is the new world of touch marketing? And, you know, we've kind of flirted with that vis-a-vis kiosks at the airport, maybe in store, but to some extent, the iPad has really brought all of that front and center.
Yeah, it taps into that base, just tactile sense that we as humans have. We're blessed with thumbs, so we like to use them for things. But even then, you know, you look at Kinect with the Xbox, which is sort of an extension of Wii, which is a little bit tangential. But again, it's people interacting with technology in whole new ways as opposed to just passive consumption.
Yeah, I think that's a great example. I do think that's another kind of disruptive innovation, or maybe it's just kind of a way of kind of catching up to the Wii in some respects, but this notion of kind of stepping into the gaming experience is, you know, a really big idea.
I feel like the gaming consoles have really found a back door, and it's going to be interesting to see what happens in 2011, because, I mean, if you look at Netflix, I think like 60% of their customers now are streaming. And it's not all through gaming consoles per se, but, you know, a good portion of it is. And, you know, I remember when they first started to decimate Blockbuster's model, it was all DVD-based, and now they consider themselves an online, streaming video company that also happens to mail DVDs. And if you think about how, you know, much they have iterated in a short period of time, they've been around, you know, a little over 10 years, under 15 years, I know that, it just blows me away how quickly that they've not only come about, but literally changed their distribution model.
Well, you know what's interesting about that is, you know, if you think about what you just described, coupled with, I'm sure someone's come up with a much better term to describe this, but this kind of new kind of this micro payment culture that's evolved largely thanks to, I think, you know, Apple. I think it just kind of created a comfort zone for us to kind of buy things in $99, $2, $3 increments. And that really kind of took on a whole ubiquitous feel this year. And, of course, I know when I look at my credit card bills, there's just, like, a lot more content. You know, the net total may be the same, but, you know, I'm doing all these micro purchases. And it'll be interesting when you kind of graph that trend on top of the way we use our TV or the way we think about the cable bill, which, you know, we're still kind of in a world of all-in-one, you know, kind of like, you know, pay a premium for the buffet and you can eat all you want. But it'll be interesting to see whether things like what's happening with Netflix or things like the way we'll rent movies on our iPads start to telegraph the TV behavior. And we just don't know how it's going to play out, but it's certainly going to be worth watching.
Very cool.
Well, if we can sort of transition into maybe a little more specific version of the highlight reel for 2010. Kevin, you want to take it away to the highlight reel section?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I think also as we get into the highlight reel, some of the smaller themes that come to mind for me are, I think, you know, like Google Buzz launching in early part of 2010, it was interesting because they did a lot of things because they could when it came to Google Buzz, but I think that forced the issue of personal privacy. And privacy has always been an undercurrent theme with the Internet, but it also forced the issue of your personal versus your professional lives because it's messy on Facebook versus a LinkedIn where that context is kind of airtight. You know, it's a professional context, but between, you know, things like Google Buzz and Facebook becoming more of a mixed bag for folks, you know, I think that those were some interesting themes as it came to your identity.
I think the bigger issue wasn't just privacy, it was just simplicity. I mean, I was just like swimming in confusion. I just couldn't figure it out. Maybe I'm just a simple-minded kind of guy, but, you know, there is a point at which too much complexity will just send us all running for the hills, and that's kind of what happened. I mean, I have Google Buzz, but I just could never quite figure it out. There's another thing they launched that was equally confusing. It just wasn't simple.
Well,
that's true.
I could never figure out the problem that it solved for me.
For Buzz?
Yeah. It was sort of like, okay, well, this is a messier version of Twitter and Facebook and everything else with a bunch of contacts in it that I don't really want. How does this help me?
You know, Google's an interesting case when it comes to social because I know they've had a tougher time. And I know that Okert has huge numbers outside of the U.S., so I'm not saying that that did not make an impact. But, you know, for some of their more recent social introductions, it's been interesting to see that the model that usually serves them pretty well has not necessarily paid off. And, Pete, I think you bring up a good point about complexity, but, you know, that's one brand. What comes to mind, Pete, when we talk about brands that won big in 2010?
Well, I think, you know, brands like, I mean, again, it really depends on, I mean, you can look at the aggregate, which is like overall business results, and sometimes that doesn't necessarily go in the same direction as like digital success. But, and I thought Best Buy continued to kind of execute really well. I think that, you know, what they were, you know, obviously they did remarkable cross-platform integration with the 12 Force, which I thought was one of the best, you know, great examples. I love the fact that it was highlighted in the TV copy, and they obviously won some big awards. But even just in the way that program was executed, you know, and I have biases. I'm pretty biased towards marketing innovation models that really highlight the role of service as part of the marketing proposition, and I thought that was well executed. I also liked it because I just still think there's a really big untapped idea around leveraging employees as a marketing asset. And, you know, there's some brands that have been doing this long before the Internet popped around, like Southwest or Nordstrom, but we are seeing a whole new set of unique benefits emerge, you know, in a social context where, you know, to some extent, with or without a strategy, most employees are active anyways, but some of the brands that are getting more organized on that front are really showing real potential. So I think Best Buy was up there. I mean, I think Zappos has been kind of been beaten to a pulp as a favorite case study.
Sure. It
still is a good case study. You know, I think, you know, and even after I read Tony's book, a lot of it was a reiteration of things we've heard from him before in speeches, but there really were some superb just business foundations in terms of the way you think about what it takes to really, you know, build a sustainable business today on the power of advocacy. I thought there were some good process innovations. I thought, you know, what Gatorade was trying to do with the war room, I thought that was powerful. The question is, how do you really scale and operationalize it? I thought that Ford had a lot of good successes. I think a lot of their success, you know, is really sourcing from kind of a different way of doing things. And I think Scott Money and others there have done a really good job. Those are just a few examples.
Now, that's interesting. I couldn't agree more. It's funny, though, you do bring up a good point about Zappos being beat to a pulp, but there is substance as to why that's happening. And in both, you know, if I look at both Zappos and Best Buy, I don't think the common thread is Twitter. I think the common thread is that they focused on making service their point of differentiation, which is why you immediately bring Nordstrom and Southwest. You know, they've been doing it before the Internet. They were just doing it differently prior to the Internet. And
it's a big reason why, you know, diapers.com was a good success story. And I think soap.com is kind of a sister company of theirs. But again, similar philosophy, which is like, how do you really create a world-class experience? How do you make it as simple as possible for the consumer to get answers? And, you know, the marketplace is rewarding that generously. It's a tougher operational nut to crack because, you know, you do have to make investment in an area that historically has been considered kind of non-strategic cost center. But this is why getting really smart about the balancing of paid, owned, and earned media is so essential, because if we really can, you know, to some extent, if we're truly media agnostic, to some extent, at the end of the day, I want favorable media impressions. I don't really care whether they're paid or whether they're earned. As long as they're favorable and as long as they nest themselves in front of other consumers who are in the purchase funnel, you know, if we get smarter about that, it's going to be much easier to reallocate dollars from things like paid advertising to customer service.
That's a good point. Yeah, I think with paid, owned, and earned, too, I think, back real quickly back to talking about the use of folks, and, you know, employees as an asset, and Best Buy tapping their employees and using Twitter to do that. To me, it's the one of the biggest challenges with social media. Typically, marketers, you know, are coming to agencies with some external social media issue. But what we found historically, even when they've done that with us, typically it's an internal challenge first. But, you know, we kind of step back and take a more holistic view of it, and you pretty quickly see, well, there's a culture issue. You know, it's not something that likes to be siloed. I mean, immediately it's discussion that, you know, legal, marketing, IT, customer service could and should probably all be involved in. I think that's one of the big stories we really didn't hear a ton about was, you know, social media making inroads internally. I know that Jeremiah Aoyang spent, you know, a good portion of the year in Altimeter working on that, and I saw some of the results and case studies through Blogwell, for example, but I think that was probably where some of the biggest work was done, was behind corporate doors, just, you know, integrating it into the organization. But I think I saw recently a stat that estimates it takes a business about 2 to 3 years to integrate social media into a business, which is, you know, interesting. That means they've been tracking this since 2007, which...
Well, they take 3 years to integrate, but the model will probably last for all of 6 months. I just think
exactly right.
I mean, all of this is going to be highly dynamic. I mean, I think the whole rationale for Nielsen pairing up with McKinsey was a recognition that social media really is bubbling up to a much more difficult enterprise question. I mean, how do you integrate this? How do you transform the internal culture? How do you align incentives? How do you... you know, shift business processes, and yeah, this was absolutely positively the year that companies started to really wrap their arms around this and think about it more than just, you know, we kind of got well beyond the, okay, let's invite consumers to create an ad, and I still think there's potential there, but I think social media is a much, much bigger idea, and I'm not even sure we're going to use the word social media in a year or two. I mean, it's just going to become synonymous with communication. So if you think about it, it's kind of solving for the broader communication issue. That's big. I mean, companies they can't grow, they can't thrive, they can't be credible if they don't have, you know, superb communication policies in place.
Well, and I think, you know, there's some companies did a better job of it than others, and some, you know, some of those mishaps turned into news stories. I mean, when we talk about the folks that didn't win quite as big in 2010, in fact, you know, the folks at the bottom of that list, who kind of comes to mind for folks that stumbled as they were trying to move ahead.
But there are some really important, you know, kind of forks in the road, and I think the Jeremiah Aoyang report kind of called that out. He said, boy, brands are kind of at a crossroads of, you know, does it become the social media help desk where it just kind of, you know, answer questions on how to, or does it become something fundamentally more strategic? And I think that's a really big issue. I think the brands that win are going to ones that are going to really, you know, you obviously have to figure out the pedestrian stuff. How do you create up a Facebook page? How do you engage? Where and how? Mm-hmm. When not to engage? But I do think there's some bigger strategic questions. Like, even things like, you know, how do you interface with trade customers? I think trade customers are just going to be on fire with social media. Many of them already are. But for manufacturers, they're going to have to figure out, okay, what are we bringing to the table that's going to make Walmart or Target or others dance with us? And, you know, I remember my P&G days, that was always the name of the game, like who could bring the best opportunities to the trade customers. And I think everyone's going to have to really put on their digital and social media caps to be competitive. And I dare say the retailers are getting really sophisticated. I think social commerce is had a big impact there. I think they're actually much more sophisticated than they give themselves credit for.
So social commerce, I mean, who kind of comes to mind as examples that stood out in 2010?
Well, I mean, I think all the, I think, you know, I mean, Walmart's got a great foundation. They've got consumer reviews on just about every single product. You've got vendors that I think are, I mean, obviously Groupon is, it was the big story of 2010, and that was just an incredible success story. I mean, we can debate the merits of should they have sold or not, but this whole notion of the consumer cartel and this reinforcement of the value of deals, especially in a down economy, is, you know, it's kind of a big message that I think we all need to internalize. It doesn't mean everyone's just going after price, but people are looking for value. And I think that, you know, Groupon didn't just bring, you know, 5 cents off. It was like 50% off. So it was almost, it was like stickier than sticky. And my guess is that we'll probably see a lot of copycat models like that. And I think there's a lot of players that have a right to do that. But yet other models like Shopkick, where you walk into the store and suddenly it knows you're there, and it kind of can seamlessly kind of offer you a deal. I think they call that proximity-based marketing, not location-based marketing. In fact, I remember listening to the guy, the CEO of Shopkick at the Charlene Lee Altimeter event, and he said something like 80% of people cheat when they're checking in the Foursquare. That was probably a very self-centered comment, because I think he's, you know, he truly believes they have a solution for that. But I just think we're going to see a lot of innovation on that front. I blogged something the other day. I don't think it was a Nielsen piece of data, but definitely caught my eye. It said something like, you know, 9 in 10 people who actively kind of use, you know, apps on their mobile phone check in when they're in the store. And if you kind of project that out in the buyer behavior, that's massive. Maybe that's the big story of the year, which is we always thought about a lot of these innovations is trying to get people to click to buy on Amazon or some other direct-to-consumer online source, but the real story was how digital and social enabled the offline purchase, which is you know, way bigger by many orders of magnitude in terms of total volume impacted.
Yeah, I agree. Like I said, I feel like it was sort of the glue. Some of those occurrences, Groupon's probably a good example too, and geolocation as it relates to you know, taking online in store, you know, apps, all of those things sort of culminated. And it is interesting to see how folks are using it. I mean, obviously, price comparison is a big one, Amazon price app. But, you know, that element of discovery, that element of the art of discovering the deal is it's pretty intriguing. And I think you mentioned some good examples of folks that have been doing it. You know, I noticed even some simpler examples of people tapping in, you know, Uniqlo, for example, they've got their Lucky Counter and used Twitter, and this is UK-based, but they use Twitter to do sort of a similar to what Walmart does on their Facebook page, where you engage enough people with a similar Groupon model, and they tweet enough about a certain product and they get the sale deal. And everybody gets it, so it was kind of interesting to see folks try it in different ways executionally, in addition to Groupon's pretty obvious approach, well-known approach, but then smaller ways like Facebook and Twitter even.
Now, on the flip side, there's a lot of untapped opportunities, and I think everybody who's in marketing today should be having that whiteboard session first day of January on, you know, what's my app? I mean, what's my value proposition? What can I bring to the trade? And there's just a lot of problems that haven't been solved. My last article on Ad Age, one of my most recent ones, was 10 apps I'd like to see in 2011. And there's still some areas. Like, you know, one of them was called the Fee Ninja. I mean, someone's got to help consumers figure out how to avoid fees.
Yeah.
Someone's going to figure it out, and it's going to be a big winner. And maybe that's something that where the brands can become a partner to, you know, consumers. But we know consumers, like, can't stand excessive extra fees, so who can help us navigate that? Another one was this notion of like a food finder. I don't know about you, but I'm just not very good at shopping. My wife may give me a list, but sometimes I'll turn on my Nike GPS thing when I'm walking through the grocery store, and when I look at it afterwards, I look like I'm schizophrenic. Back and forth, but you know, someone's going to create a really good food finder, and it'll know that if you're at the Kroger in Kentucky or Northern Kentucky, exactly where the carrots are or whatever, you know, and then those are the things that are going to become really, you know, practical. Or I'd like to see someone come up with an app that for lack of a better word, you know, think of like a kiddie curator where you can actually program what kids can do on the iPad. So, you know, if they want to watch a Mickey Mouse video on YouTube, that's fine, but you have to play chess first, and you have to do a couple drawings. No one's really cracked the code on an app that allows a parent to kind of almost force kids to pass go after certain types of activities, which I actually think could have huge pedagogical value. But my guess is that in the 2001, to the question about what to add, I think we're just going to see an unbelievable fire hydrant of innovation. Because none of these things are real tech barriers. I mean, I don't think technology is a barrier anymore. I think the only thing that's limiting us is, like, you know, our kind of consumer fundamentals. What are kind of really thinking about unmet consumer needs, and what are the ideas that kind of fill those needs?
Yeah, I'm still pondering the GPS, grocery positioning system, if you will.
Yeah, it's going to business. I think it's a big idea, man. Targeting ads, too. I think, I mean, much as I, you know, guys always look clueless when I see them in the store.
Yeah. No, I always make the schizophrenic run. I mean, I'm always going back five aisles after I've, you know, gone through the whole store because I forgot something. I think geofencing, like, you know, ShopKit's one of the things that comes to mind, and I think there's a lot of opportunity there at the store level. And, you know, are there ways that the big thing is, you know, whatever it is, and I think why mobile's been so strong is that it hasn't forced the store, you know, to many degrees, hasn't really forced the store to put another layer of technology or training in, because that's the big thing. I mean, you know, you put a shelf talker on a, you know, one shelf, doesn't seem like a big deal, but if you're doing it across, you know, 200, 2,000 stores, it's a much bigger deal. And that's why mobile's been so great, and geolocation's been such a big deal at the retail level. But, you know, we talked a little bit about Google. As far as some of the other big technology brands, you know, what do you make of how 2010 will be looked back on for folks like Facebook kind of comes to mind immediately, but, you know, other brands like, say, Twitter and even Microsoft?
Well, I think they're all kind of making, you know, serious progress in their own right. I mean, I think Microsoft made a ton of, I mean, Microsoft's one of our bigger clients, so I just full disclosure, but I do think they made meaningful progress with Bing. I think they kind of carved out kind of a beachhead on the whole search front, and I think, you know, who knows where that will lead. You know, at the same time, there's no question they're challenged by, you know, some would argue that apps are kind of de facto software, right? And it's just a widely distributed software market, and that creates both challenges and opportunities. But I think, you know, I mean, Facebook, I mean, what can I say? I mean, 550 million global users. And, you know, they've got an innovation machine. They, you know, what I admire about them is they really do have, they're very disciplined to feedback loops. So they might, you know, start a riot here and there, but they really absorb it immediately. You think of most companies, it's like, you know, just they have an infrastructure to kind of respond to feedback. In the case of Facebook, I think they've done a really good job. And, you know, they've obviously got some new, fresh questions that have emerged around privacy. And, you know, there's this adherence to this notion that the whole, everybody in the younger generation just wants to share. You know, that's a good topic for debate. I'm not sure. I think we may see some revisionism there, and I'm not sure the government is going to have as much patience with a lot of those assumptions.
Right, right. Well, and that gets to go back to that privacy discussion earlier with Facebook, and I think another thing that'll be interesting to track in 2011 is just what I'm, you know, calling right now sort of the self-entitlement of users, that feeling of self-entitlement, and, you know, these are free services, and, yeah, granted, it's my data on there, but it's Facebook's territory, and, you know, even as it relates to something as trivial as well as Facebook, paid, owned, or earned, yes, it's all, they can be all free, right? And that whole concept of ownership, and because, you know, I see things like Twitter, you know, recently Tumblr broke down for a decent portion of time, I think, you know, within like 2 days, but it was interesting to watch the comments immediately. You know, Tumblr was deemed the Antichrist for being down, you know, and it's a free service. So, okay, they had a problem. They probably could have done a better job of setting expectations for how long it would take to fix, but, you know, how much can you complain if it's a free service? So I think that'll be interesting to see in 2011 how that kind of pans out.
Yeah, I think on the Twitter side, it'll be just interesting to see how their ad model unfolds. I think so far it's been, you know, it seems like it's worked pretty well. But, you know, sometimes when I see a brand with, you know, promoted tweets and I see they've got like 15,000, I kind of wonder, like, did they earn it or did they just buy it?
Right.
And it's going to get a little harder to kind of, you know, when I see that Kevin Dugan's got, you know, oh my gosh, the guy's got like 5,000 more followers than me. I don't doubt for a second, like, this guy's blogging, he's putting out good thoughts, he deserves to be way ahead of me. Now it's going to be a lot more confusing. You're going to see brands with all these followers, and you think, okay, well, did they just, like, write a check, or was it real? And so it's going to be interesting. This is where advertising can, you know, I think advertising models are obviously essential. That's what makes the economy work. But it'll create some confusion. I mean, we'll kind of, you know, is it real or Memorex? You know?
Yeah.
So we won't know, and I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of, you know, people like you and me start to, like, shell out advertising because we see the social currency of boosting our numbers. You know what I mean?
Sure.
So it'll be interesting to see how that whole space evolves.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you brought up some good examples there, and clearly we haven't seen the end of it, that's for sure. You know, I've seen individuals buying Facebook ads, now that you mention it. Maybe it goes from being an initial quantitative read, like you said, in the, looking at the specs and how many followers folks have, and it has to become more of a qualitative read, meaning, well, if the content doesn't look very engaging and they got a huge count, that's probably a red flag that they might have bought it, right? I mean, it's just not going to be as easy as it used to be to figure some of those things out.
I mean, again, think about, like, the foundations of social media. I mean, a lot of it is really kind of grounded in this notion of authenticity. Be authentic. That's what really ultimately gets you the reward. Now we're kind of at this interesting, you know, intersection of kind of authenticity and advertising, which, you know, one could argue by its very nature is kind of artificially, because you're kind of like buying awareness and impressions. And it's not that it's bad. It just, it may throw confusing signals into the mix. So it'll be really interesting how things evolve. I mean, the same can be said for all the companies that are doing proactive engagement, whether it's movie studios or TV studios or, you know, everyday brands. I mean, they're a very significant percentage of the buzz these days is really being driven by the brands themselves. And when a new product launches, a very significant percentage is driven by people like you and me, the marketers. We're the ones that feel that irresistible urge to say something about a brand campaign before average Joe, and that...
Right.
Very significant consequences that kind of embeds itself in Google search results, which ultimately impacts kind of the early viewers or kind of triers of the brand. It can also work to counter effect, too. We did an analysis of the gap issue, and what I thought was kind of interesting was very similar to Motrin Moms, where plus 50% of the early buzz ripping into the gap because of what was perceived to be a bad logo decision. Most of it was coming from, like, marketers. It was coming from, like, you that had design experience, but happens to do social media really well. And that's a very, very interesting dynamic. And I think brands are going to have to really think about this, especially in a world where resumes are less relevant. What you basically got today is kind of this marketplace of, you know, our blogs, our tweets. They're kind of like our de facto resume. It's what keeps us competitive in the marketplace. And so you're just going to have almost like a more sophisticated commentator. I don't know if sophisticated is the right word. It's like a commentator who's more of the industry, and that has really big consequences. In fact, you can say the most important strategy in launching a product is not trying to find the power moms, but trying to find the marketing influencers, because they're the first ones that are going to leave the digital trail, positive or negative. And that's a different model of marketing.
A way different.
A lot of listeners probably very intrigued about that concept.
And if you type in any brand that kind of had some trouble this year, whether it was Recall or Greenpeace or whatever, and you type it into Google, most of, like, the negatives that show up are all from marketing bloggers.
Sure.
It's not like average Joe. And again, that's not to say that, you know, that it still matters, because average Joe is the one doing the searching and ultimately stumbles into Kevin Dugan's post. So you have to take it seriously, but it's just who we need to influence in the early stages of a product launch is different.
Yeah.
Well, you know, another beat to death example, but be remiss if I didn't mention the Old Spice guy in 2010, right? It was sort of the converse of that. They figured out, how do we get these people, the digital influencers, really excited about Old Spice, and then get Joe Average out there to watch a video project about the Old Spice guy.
But I think even there, I think that was a good example of really hitting the mainstream pretty aggressively. But even there, I think they got a nice lift and accelerator, if you will, from people like you and me that were just so awed by the fact that they pulled it off. I mean, there's so many different angles of that story. You know, the big story with that campaign is that P&G said, one agency only, and they actually pulled it off. I mean, you had the TV agency actually kind of pull off an integrated, you know, campaign, and it kind of worked. And but a lot of marketers that kind of gave that early high five, and that kind of kept that thing aggressively in play. I think the other thing I liked about that campaign is that, you know, if you think about what they did, I mean, they, you know, they really leveraged feedback loops. They took real-time comments, and they kind of turned it into content in real time, and I thought that was a really powerful insight. I continue to believe most brands really don't take full advantage of things like consumer relations or contact us or, you know, that's kind of considered research or, you know, it's kind of divorced from the marketing or engagement process.
You know, what's interesting with that, too, is, I mean, that one really, you talked about the early influencer product launch. I mean, they were actually gaining steam on that, you know, what was kind of a Old Spice blitz. I mean, they were started after the Super Bowl, but close enough to after that folks thought that the campaign launched during the Super Bowl, which I thought was interesting. And, you know, so it's one of those second options if you can't get the Super Bowl advertising, get for as early as possible after it. you know, it went above and beyond the blitz itself, and I think it speaks to what you were talking about the latency, Pete, of social media. You do need to look at it, I guess my point is broader than just the blitz itself, but I was pretty impressed that agency did pull it off. I mean, it was pretty quick, pretty intense, and you know, the before and after I think helped make it a success as well. But it was interesting to see that how well that worked.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Well, cool. I think that kind of gets us over to 2011. And as old man Father Time, I will pass it over to Mr. Bowman.
Well, we are well into the podcast, so maybe with 2011, the appropriate thing to do is lightning round. Pete, give us sort of a quick take on all of the following. So, location-based services, is this where it's at or whereabouts unknown for 2011?
I think it'll continue to be a big deal.
Okay. QR codes, fancy fad, or fascinating facts of life?
Pretty big. I think they're going to see a lot of activity there. I just think, I mean, the proof in the pudding's in the numbers. I mean, you know, tools like Red Laser and a lot of these QR code readers are, you know, among the stickiest apps, so therefore they're going to have to read something, right? And I think it's going to be up to the marketers to come up with creative ways of taking advantage of that connection.
So should I be doing this in John McLaughlin's voice?
I don't know. Maybe.
Tablet computing, transient or transformational?
Morton Kondracki.
Eleanor. So what say you, the tablet PC, the tablet computer, is this a transient fad or is this a transformational device?
Oh, I think it's transformational. I think we're just beginning to see how this is going to be a game changer.
Internet television.
In trying to figure it out for 2010, I noticed part of the industry seems to be referencing tablets separately. Another part wraps them in as netbooks. And probably the smallest amount do that, and then the other group tends to wrap them into PCs. So it's hard getting a very accurate read on what happened in 2010. But suffice to say, I think it's a pretty big challenger for netbooks. In fact, I think they predict that tablets will pretty quickly overtake netbook sales.
What about internet television? Absolutely awful or amazingly awesome?
I think it's continuing to march. I mean, I think there's been a few false starts, but I think it's kind of transformational.
All right, here's one.
Any single dominant player that's going to own the space, but we've just got a lot of entrants and a lot of exciting activity.
Super Bowl ads, return to sender or return to relevance?
I'm not sure I understand the question, but I would say that Super Bowl ads are just going to get a lot more sophisticated, a lot more integrated. I think price, you know, cross-platform integration, you know, paid plus earn plus own are going to become table stakes for successful spots. And I'm really excited about the fact that so many auto players are back in, because I do think auto players have gotten, it really led other industries and social media sophistication. So I would be shocked if we didn't see a lot of innovation there. And I think one thing to watch for is, like, the brand websites kind of get dissed in favor of kind of direct to Facebook or direct to Twitter promotions. That'll be interesting to watch.
2011, personal privacy, a major concern or a minor consideration?
Well, I think the fact that the government is looking at this, I mean, it has to be a major concern. Anyone who's got their head in the sand is just not being realistic. So whether you agree or disagree, the government's asking hard questions, whether it's, you know, FCC or FTC, and I think we always need to take that seriously. And I think, you know, in their heart of hearts, they believe that they're kind of taking the side of the consumer, and I think we need to be very sensitive to that. And I think, you know, I'm very involved in that because I chair the National Council of Better Business Bureau, and they're very involved in a lot of the self-regulatory work, especially around behavioral advertising or interest-based advertising. And we're all taking it very seriously. So hopefully we'll find a nice win-win, medium on all of it.
Well, that concludes the lightning round. Let's sort of sum it up with regards to marketing and technology in 2011. What do you guys think we ought to be paying attention to?
Well, you know, again, I think the big thing that I know Empower, my employer, is going to be focused on in 2011 is just going to be how digital technology, you know, I think in the past, digital is considered a channel that, you know, it's a technology that's really woven its way through all the different silos that have been used to organize media in the past. And I think those silos have all been dissolved at this point. So, you know, I know that Pete is considered paid, owned, and earned media, sort of the blending of that, a disruptive trend for the coming year, and I couldn't agree more. You know, we're going to be monitoring how that trend is impacting the consumer and how the brand needs to kind of react to that. In fact, you heard it here first. I'm assuming this podcast won't get posted prior to me launching the site tomorrow. But
we're live.
NoChannels.com will be launching here at some point tomorrow, my Christmas present to the paid, owned, and earned space, and just kind of encapsulates everything that we've done to date on the topic, and has some new stuff in there too that we'll be using to hopefully create a conversation around the topic and really get people focused on it.
And that's nochannels.com?
Nochannelsplural.com, yes.
Nice.
I like it.
Pete, what do you think?
Good evening, you guys.
What's that? Yeah.
This is great. I hope we can do it again.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you have any closing thoughts for 2011, Pete?
No, I think, you know, I think a lot of the same old things. It's going to stay focused on the consumer, keep things simple. Don't drown in the technology. I think we're all kind of guilty of that. Keep our head up. I think we're kind of in a heads down culture. You know, you hop on the plane and everyone's like looking at their iPhone. I think we've forgotten how to talk to one another. So I think we need to really kind of rediscover balance. And I think we'll find even more benefits to technology when we approach it that way. So,
well, that was one.
I remain optimistic, and I think we're in for a lot of exciting times.
Yeah, that was one of the good takeaways I had from Sum It Up was when you were speaking, you talked about a visit, I believe it was to a grade school, or you were talking to some teenagers just about what they were up to and how
incredible.
Yeah, how informative that was and sort of transformational for you. And it's like, yeah, when is the last time I actually went out and just asked people some questions?
Yeah, good old-fashioned focus group. Don't over-rely on Facebook or Twitter. Just, you know, grab some friends' coffee and listen to them. I mean, it's amazing what you can learn by trusting the flesh.
Well, gentlemen, I want to thank you for helping us put together another fabulous episode of Marketing FYI. It's been a pleasure to chat with you guys today, pick your brains, and just wanted to say thank you so much.
You bet. We'll talk soon.
Thanks, Pete.
Have a happy holidays, guys.
You